Okay, everyone, so let's get started here. And as you probably know, it's going to be the continuation of the Maha Parinibbana Sutta, the greater sutta on the Buddha's passing away. And this is session number 8, I think. So instead, we're not even halfway through, so it's kind of exciting. Yes, this is a long, exciting story. And just to kind of give you just a brief reminder of what this is about, for those of you who may not know, I'm sure most of you probably know already, but just as a recap, because it's so long between each session, this is the Buddha's last journey, when he starts out at Rajagaha, the ancient capital of the Magadhan kingdom, and he walks from there all the way to the place where he eventually passes away, which is in Kushinara. And those of you who have been to India, you will have seen those places. Now he's kind of halfway on that route between Rajagaha and Kushinara. And this is in Vaisali. The Vaisali is the ancient capital of the Vajjayan Republic. Yeah. And one of the chief cities in India at the time, and this was one of the places where the Buddha would visit quite often. And now he's just been there, and he has just had a meeting with Ambapali, a very famous courtesan at the time, who donated a large her mango grove to the Sangha to use as a residence for the Sangha. So that has just happened. We just finished with that. And now we're going to continue on from there. Is Mara making troubles for us? Are we all right? Yeah, good? Okay, good. Okay, yeah. Excellent. Great. So that's what's happening now. So he has just finished the meeting with Ambapali, the donation or the giving of the mango grove. And now we come to the next one. And this is what happens next. Paragraph 221 on that screen there. Then, so it said, and when the Lord had stayed at Ambapali's grove as long as he wished, and then there's a dot, dot, dot. I wonder what that dot, dot, dot is. It's always kind of concerning when you see dots. Let's see if I can find a full version of this. Shouldn't be that hard. Should be many of these around. Yeah, so this is probably okay. So probably just he has stayed as long as he wished, and he said to Ananda, "Let us go to this other place, Beluvagamika." And he said, "Very good." And then with a large company of monks, they went to this village, a little village of Beluvagamika, where he stayed. So still in the vicinity of Vaisali, this is very close by to Vaisali. And there the Lord said to the monks, "You monks should go to anywhere in Vaisali where you have friends and acquaintances or supporters and spend the rains there. I shall spend the rainy season here in Beluva." "Very good, Lord," replied the monks, and they did so. But the Lord spent the rains in Beluva. So it seems at this time that the Buddha had quite a large entourage traveling with him. You see, it's always a large company of monks, and presumably there may have been nuns there, and perhaps probably quite likely lay people as well. And they probably knew that this was an important time in the Buddha's life, and they were kind of following him around. As he got older, he had a larger and larger company of people following him around, because he was becoming very famous. And now he wants a bit of solitude for the rainy season. Here you can see that in those days too, they practiced this idea of the rainy season retreat. Just like we do now at Bodhinyana Monastery, Dhammasara Monasteries, and all monastics around the world, that was already instituted at this particular time. So this is an ancient tradition going all the way back to the time of the Buddha. And sometimes it appears even the lay people had a rainy season in those days, because it was very difficult to travel around India at that time. And then he says to his monks, "Go and spend the rains wherever you have supporters." And of course, part of the idea here is that when you have such a large entourage, you can't you have to kind of spread out a little bit so that you don't become a burden for the lay people in that little village. And this is one of those important principles in monastic life, is the idea that you don't become a burden for the people around you, the supporters. And this is something you see in other suttas. There's a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya 32, I think it is, called the Gopalaka Sutta, the cowherd. Gopalaka literally means the guardian of the cows. And in that sutta, he compares the guarding of cows or cow herding to how we should live the monastic life. And he says, you know, you shouldn't milk dry the cows. In the same way, you have to be careful with how you how monastics relate to lay people. And it's a similar kind of thing that you see here, the idea of spreading out and not and being careful how you deal with the support that you have. You should appreciate your support. It shouldn't be a burden for society. It should be a mutual joy that we can support each other. It should not be a burden on any one of the parties. It should be something for growth in the Dhamma, not something that you makes you kind of resentful or whatever. So they did that. So they spent the rains retreat in various places, and then while during the rains, the Lord was attacked by a severe sickness, with sharp pains, as if he were about to die. Or it's like death-like suffering is really the Pali word there. Maranantika suffering. But he endured all of this mindfully and clearly aware, sati sampajanya, and without, not without complaining. That's not what the Pali says at all. It's like more like without being distressed is actually the right translation there. But then he thought, it is not fitting that I should attain final Nibbana without addressing my followers. Actually, my attendants, upatak is the Pali word there. It's the same word we use in the present day to talk about attendants. And taking leave of the order of monks. I must hold this disease in check by energy and apply myself to the force of life. And he did so, and the disease abated. So, this little passage is in many ways quite interesting, in the sense that here you see the Buddha. He's obviously here getting very close to the end of his life. He has pains that are close to death-like pains. Yeah, he's getting kind of this sensation that he's coming to the end of his life, and it's becoming very clear, and he has to make a deliberate determination that he's going to not pass away quite yet. Yeah, and this is fascinating, because here you can see that the Buddha actually has to deliberately stop himself from dying, just like many people do in the present day. If you have a degree of, if you still have that will to live, you tend to live longer. If you lose your will to live, people die very quickly. And this is almost like what the Buddha is doing here. And this is a very natural thing. This is what we kind of expect to happen with people. Yeah, you get older, the body is falling apart, you can feel that you're getting very close to death. It's just about to happen. And a very common experience. And this is interesting because it contrasts with what we see later on in this sutta. Later on in this sutta, the Buddha famously has this conversation with Mara, and then Mara tells him to pass away. Yeah, and then Ananda is on the scene, and Ananda, the Buddha gives a hint to Ananda. The hint is something like, you know, the Buddha can live on for the kappa. Kappa is an eon, if he wishes. Hint, hint, please ask me to stay on for an eon. Yeah, the Buddha can live on for an eon. Get it? You get it? No. It's almost like that. It's a very strange kind of situation. And we look at this later on. The Buddha seems to be hinting to Ananda. Ananda doesn't get it. And for that reason, the Buddha passes away. It's very weird. And it's not something that you would expect of a spiritual teacher like the Buddha at all, in my opinion. So there is a contrast between this idea that the Buddha, on the one hand, seems to say that he could live on for the eon, and on the other hand, this sort of passage where the Buddha says, well, actually, I'm dying now already. I have to apply myself to the force of life to even last a few days longer so I can talk to my monastic disciples. Yeah? So which one of these accounts is true? Is it the more the supernatural accounts where the Buddha is talking to Mara and he can keep his body going for an eon? I hate to think what these bodies would look like after an eon. Yeah, after 80, 100 years, they already kind of start to fall apart. Can you imagine? And so what is going on? How come there are these two conflicting views, two conflicting ideas in the sutta? And this actually comes up in many places, that there is a conflict between what I would call more like a supernatural element on the one hand, and a more natural way of understanding these things on the other hand. And I think what is going on is that there actually are two conflicting views going on here. One is the views, the ideas that sprung up after the Buddha passed away. Remember, the Mahapanibbana Sutta was put together after the Buddha passed away. How do we know that? Well, it includes element from the Buddha's funeral and all of that. So we know it must have happened after the Buddha passed away. And also it is a narrative. A narrative is not spoken by the Buddha, obviously, it's given by someone else. So all of this indicates this is quite a late sutta compared to the other one. It's not actually the word of the Buddha. So for that reason, it is quite plausible, I think, that after the Buddha passed away, people wanted to explain this. How come the Buddha passed away like that? We want to have an explanation of this. And then they remember the Buddha, and of course what they want to emphasize, maybe out of faith or whatever, is this kind of supernatural element. And then they were added to the sutta, to the more naturalistic ideas that were already there beforehand. And then you have this conflict between two different things. This is what I think may have happened. I mean, this is just speculation, not quite speculation, educated guess or whatever, but it seems to be something like that is actually happening in this particular sutta. And I think it's strange because, people do this out of faith in the Buddha. Let's put those elements in that are more kind of fancy and not really naturalistic. They do it out of faith to enhance the status and the authority of the Buddha, because someone who has these qualities, wow, they are really worthy of faith. And this would have been what particularly probably lay people at that time, how they thought about a spiritual master. They had to have something really fancy going on with them, and that's what made them special. But actually, I think from a modern point of view, the naturalistic idea of the Buddha is far more powerful, because it makes us able to relate to the Buddha as a fellow human being, rather than as some kind of almost like a freak, who can live on for the eon. I mean, who can possibly live on for an eon? Doesn't make any sense, really. I prefer to kind of try to sort out, pull out those more natural elements and see the Buddha as a human being. To me, that makes much more sense, because then we can relate to him, and then his teachings become far more powerful, because then he is teaching to us as a fellow human being, person to person. He understands us, we understand him, and then of course it makes far more sense because of that. So this is something to be on the lookout for in the Mahapanibbana Sutta, this additional elements that are slightly supernatural or supernormal or whatever you want to call it. And this is something you see throughout the suttas, this sometimes the addition of supernormal elements. And the reason we know that is because sometimes the same sutta occurs in different languages, and the supernatural element will be there in one place, not in another sutta. So you get this feeling that things have been changed over time. So I think what we're seeing here, I think, is quite likely to be a fairly authentic version of what actually happened. So this is what is nice about this particular sutta. He endured it all mindfully and clearly aware. This is what you kind of would expect of the Buddha, and without being too distressed, because he obviously had access to deep meditation states, and this is what we will see in a second, actually, that he had access to those, and then he could kind of relax a little bit and kind of get away a little bit. But you can see that even for the Buddha, it was obviously not pleasant. And that's kind of the problem. As long as you have a body, it's going to be unpleasant at times. And then he has this thought, it is not fitting that I should attain final Nibbana without addressing my followers and taking leave of the order of monks. Followers, his attendants, I guess that he sort of wants to say goodbye, now I'm going, and obviously also taking leave of the order of monks here probably means like giving maybe a last message, yeah, that summarizes his teachings and giving the last kind of piece of advice. And this is also what we see later on in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, that he gives the last pieces of advice towards the very end to make it clear how they should practice, how they should go on after he passes away. And these pieces of advice is actually what makes this sutta so exciting and interesting, because here the Buddha is kind of summarizing what his teaching is all about. He's laying down the rules, how we should deal with the sasana, how we should deal with the Dhamma after he passes away. He hasn't really spoken about that much before, because it hasn't been required. But now when he's about to die, he's forced to talk about these things. And this, of course, is very, I think, is very interesting, because it is very applicable to how we should deal with the Dhamma now in the present time. So this sutta is actually very, for that reason, very practical and very useful for us as a part of the later generations of Buddhism. And this is obviously what I think what he's talking about here. Yeah, I need to kind of let my say proper goodbye and then give them some last instructions so that they kind of they know what they have to do. I can't just pass away in obscurity. It wouldn't really be appropriate. Of course, the Buddha is also showing here that what you would expect, he has a little bit of control over when he's passing away. It's not just a random act, which is true. Most people have a little bit of control over that. I must hold this disease in check by energy, virya, and apply myself to the force of life. And he did so, and the disease abated. The force of life is the jivita sankhara. Jivita is life. Sankhara is this word in Pali which is very multifaceted, but it means things like will. It also means things like force, as you say here. So one way of translating this is that I must apply myself, or I must focus on the will to live. I keep that will to live going. Again, this is kind of what we know. It's very common, yeah? If people lose the will to live, you die pretty quickly. But if you have that will to live, you can actually make the body last a little bit longer as a consequence. And of course, for the Buddha, he probably didn't really have much will to live, yeah? Except if he, you know, if there was something that needed to be done, for he'd probably be happy. The body is getting old. What's the point of dragging around this old body? He'd probably be very happy to just disappear, get out of here once and for all. Yeah, probably had enough of this body and all the kind of the people asking him questions all the time. Ajahn Brahma was asking about, says about all the people asking him questions. That's Ajahn Brahma. Imagine the Buddha, how many people he had asking him questions all the time. Yeah. And one of the kind of weird things in the Vinaya Pitaka, is the discipline for the monks and the nuns, and not just the discipline, but also the all the regulations on how we deal in a communal setting and all of this kind of stuff. And every time there is a tiny thing that happens among the monastics, they go to the Buddha, Master, this happened, what should we do with this? And sometimes I feel so sorry for the Buddha. I feel, jeepers, all these tiny little things that we have to answer all the time. Oh, Master, how often can I cut my nails or something like that? No, that's not actually not in there. I'm just making something up to sound really silly. But it's almost like that. Yeah, it's all these tiny little things, and the Buddha seems to always get involved. And these monastics sometimes they seem a little bit helpless, like little children. And I think this is precisely the problem, is that when you have someone like the Buddha, everyone does become a little bit like children, because he is regarded so highly. You become a little bit afraid of doing anything without asking the Buddha's advice. And this is why when the Buddha passes away, it becomes a massive vacuum. Yeah, it becomes a big hole. And that's when you start to see these supernormal stories and things emerging as a consequence. The Buddha, I don't know, he probably didn't have all that much will to live. He'd actually had to summon up that will to live to be able to carry on long enough to pass on that message that was kind of necessary for the sasana and Dhamma to carry on into the future. So that's what he does. So he applies himself to energy. Energy is one of these factors that usually lead to a kind of prolonging of the body. This is the natural energy of the mind. This is not a reference to using willpower. Sometimes we think of energy as using force or willpower or whatever, but this is not what it means in the suttas. Energy in the suttas refers to the natural energy of the mind. So I'm sure you know what I mean. Sometimes you feel dull, yeah, no energy in the mind, or kind of, oh. Other times you feel the mind is energetic, yeah. Yeah, you feel bright inside. And that brightness in the mind, this is what we're talking about here. And that seems to have very powerful healing capabilities. You see this in several places in the suttas. Sometimes you see the Buddha, people getting others to recite the bhujangas. The bhujangas are the factors of awakening, yeah? And the factors of awakening, they go through the sequence, starting with mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, in other words, investigation of qualities or teachings. And then you have the energy here, yeah? So energy arises as you go through the sequence of bhujangas, or awakening factors. And so the Buddha, even the Buddha, would ask one of the monks when he was ill to please recite the bhujangas. And the monk would recite the bhujangas, and then the Buddha would listen, and presumably by listening, that energy would be aroused, yeah? Maybe his energy was low because of the illness, energy would be aroused, and then somehow the illness is abated through this. A positive mind, the bright mind, is what often combats illnesses. And that too is actually fairly well known from modern medical science, is that apparently it has been shown that people who are taken to hospital, people who have a positive state of mind, who are more bright and positive, they fare much better when it comes to operations and things. They come out faster, they heal better, and all these kind of things. So it seems to be a fairly fairly kind of, again, natural thing. It's not something supernatural going on there, I would say. Yeah. Anyway, so he does that. He applies himself to the force of life. The disease abates. And then he meets Venerable Ananda next, and this is what happens as they meet. The Lord, having recovered from his sickness, as soon as he felt better, went outside and sat on the prepared seat in front of his dwelling. It should actually be in the shade of his dwelling, is actually the Pali. Then the Venerable Ananda came to him, bowed down to him, sat down to one side and said, Lord, I have seen the Lord in comfort, I have seen the Lord patient endurance. But Lord, my body was like a drunkard's. I lost my bearings, and things were unclear to me because of the Lord's sickness. The only thing that was of some comfort to me was the thought, the Lord will not attain final nibbana until he has made some statement about the order of monks. So here we have Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's right-hand attendant. He has been around the Buddha for 20 years, and he has never have any kind of contempt, none of this familiarity breeds contempt thing. He's actually, this is actually referenced in the sutta, seems to have been a known saying even at that time. But Ananda didn't have that, even after 20 years around the Buddha, no contempt. Yeah, so he obviously had a lot of confidence in the Buddha. And being so close, he would have been the person who felt the Buddha's passing away, perhaps more than anyone. And you can see this is exactly what is happening here. Even though he, at this point, he would already have been a stream enter, even though he had seen the Dhamma, surprisingly, he still is really affected by the Buddha's passing away. He's like a drunkard, he says here. The directions are not clear. This is this idea of losing my bearings. The directions are not clear, is what it means. Even Ananda, and you can imagine how much worse it would have been for the rest of the community, the rest of the Buddhist sasana at that particular time, if even Venerable Ananda was in such a problematic thing. And this is another thing that we will come to later on, is this sense of loss that arises in the Sangha as the Buddha is about to pass away. Even Venerable Ananda here having that same problem. It's a little bit strange the way this is translated. I have seen the Lord in comfort. I have seen the Lord's patient endurance. What exactly is it talking about? And I think what it means is that he has now seen the Buddha after he has come out of the illness. He has seen that he's now well again and happy. He's back to feeling comfortable again. I think that's what actually is the meaning here. So I've seen this, but even though I have seen this, even though I have seen and that the Buddha is now okay, still, I have this problem that I, things seemed like a drunkard. So despite the fact, because he realized something is going on, the Buddha is on the way out, there is a serious problem going on here. So this is, I think, the idea behind this. A little bit strange the way it is formulated, especially the English translation, but I think it kind of makes sense. So, and also the things were unclear to me is another not very good translation here. Things here are actually Dhamma, and the word Dhamma in this particular context actually refers to teachings. Yeah, so even the teaching is unclear to me. And this is what happens if you kind of fall, you know, if you things get very problematic, you become very sad or whatever, you completely lose your guidance in life. The teachings disappear, your ability to see right from wrong, everything kind of dissolves as a consequence of your sadness or whatever it is. So everything kind of falls apart. Delusion is always a tremendous problem on the path, and we forget what is right, what is wrong, and we're no longer able to function properly as a consequence. Even Venerable Ananda, it is happening to right here. And then he says, again, this idea that there was some comfort for him, that the Lord will not attain final Nibbana until he has made some statement about the order of monks. And the idea here is a statement is like an announcement. He expects the Buddha to make some sort of announcement, and presumably that refers to the idea of passing on the leadership of the Sangha. Yeah, you make an announcement about what's going to happen to the Buddhist teachings and the Dhamma after his passing away. So he's expecting the Buddha to kind of pass on the baton, if you like, to the next generation. Yeah, this is sort of what this seems to be referring to. How is the order going to function now? How is the Dhamma going to be held together? This is what this means. It is different from what the Buddha is saying before, where the Buddha talks about taking leave of the order. Taking leave of the order just means kind of summarizing things. What Ananda seems to be asking for is something more, the idea of actually passing on the leadership, if you like. And what comes next is quite interesting, because this is the Buddha's answer to this idea of passing on leadership. Should there be a leadership transition or should there not? How does this Dhamma function? How does it compare to other teachings or other ways of dealing with of leading organizations or whatever it is? And this is how the Buddha replies to this. But Ananda, what does the order of monks expect of me? I have taught the Dhamma, Ananda, we know inner and outer. The Tathagata has no teacher's fist in respect of doctrines or teachings. If there is anyone who thinks I shall take charge of the order, or the order should refer to me, let him make some statement or announcement about the order. But the Tathagata does not think in such terms. So why should the Tathagata make an announcement about the order? And this is a very famous saying by the Buddha, and obviously this is precisely where we come to the Buddha summarizing his what his teachings are all about, coming to the very end of the life. This is part of what I was referring to before. First of all, you have this, I have taught the Dhamma, making no inner and outer. The idea behind that seems to be, is always understood to mean that there is no inner kind of circle of disciples and an outer circle of lesser disciples outside. There is no distinction between the disciples, basically. There is no inner core group that kind of gets all the teachings and an outer core that gets the easier teachings. The same teachings are basically available to anyone. And this is a very important principle, because one of the things that if you have read a little bit about cults, and of course cults have a tendency to arise quite easily within religions, the idea in cults, one of the things that is often used to create a cult is this idea of having a special inner core, you know, who actually get access to special teachings. And everyone is kind of outside of that. And then you create this competition almost among the outer disciples to get access to this inner teachings. There's always this kind of move, and then once you get into the inner core, the inner sanctum, or whatever you want to call it, then you feel special because you have been given these special teachings. So it is used as a way of controlling people and manipulating. This is how you manipulate and control people, by giving special teachings and special access in this particular way. And that is how you, one of the I think, fairly well-known characteristics of cults. There was a British English psychologist called Anthony Storr or something like that who wrote about this, and this was one of the characteristics that he came up with of a typical for a cult. Of course, exactly the exact boundaries here are very hard to draw, but the Buddhist teaching is the exact opposite. Yeah, it should not be cultish at all. Everything should always be accessible to people. There shouldn't be an inner or outer. The Tipitaka is there. If you want to read it, you read it. And there's nothing really secret about these teachings. And there shouldn't be. Why not? Because these teachings are all there. They're spoken out of compassion. Yeah, they're there to help us, they're there to support us, they're there to kind of move us in the right direction, to help us in our lives. So why should we keep things secret from anyone? It doesn't make any sense. And then what you have instead, you have this very open teaching where there is very little sense of being manipulated or pushed around or anything like that, and everything is very kind of flat structure where everyone has roughly the same access to these things. So I think this is a very beautiful part of Buddhism, this idea of the flatness of the Buddhist teachings. And it is not just in terms of access to the teaching, it's also in terms of many other things as well, that we have this flatness of structure. And I'll talk about that maybe just a little bit more in a second here. And the second thing he says here is this idea of the Tathagata having no teacher's fist, yeah, in respect of doctrines. In other words, he doesn't have anything to add. He hasn't kind of held something back to the very last moment now to impart it to his disciple in the very last moment. So he instead, everything is always there. Everything is always available. Everything is out there from the very beginning. There's nothing now which can be added to what he has already said before. So no teacher's fist, no kind of special doctrines that have been kind of held back or kept back or whatever. Then he says, if there is anyone who thinks I shall take charge of the order should refer to me, let him make some statement or announcement about the order. So he's saying, well, if anyone thinks like that, please go ahead. But the Tathagata does not think in such terms. In other words, the Buddha himself, I don't think in such terms. So because I don't think like that, why should I make an announcement about the order? It's quite remarkable in a sense. The Buddha does not see himself as I shall lead the order. The order should refer to me. He doesn't think like that. Quite amazing, isn't it? Here we have the Buddha, who obviously is the leader of the order. Everyone kind of goes to the Buddha all the time. Everyone refers to him, even with the tiniest matter, to the point where you really do feel a bit sorry for the Buddha, having to deal with all this tiny stuff. And yet the Buddha doesn't see himself in that light. So why is that? I think the obvious answer is that the Buddha does all of these things out of a sense of duty, out of a sense of compassion, but not because he sees himself as a leader or as an authority or anything like that. Because seeing yourself as a leader very often has to do perhaps with a personality view. Yeah, you see yourself in a particular position. Perhaps you see yourself as an authority. It is very closely related to our sense of self and who we are. But of course, the Buddha doesn't really have that anymore. He does things purely out of compassion, not for any ulterior motives outside or beyond that. So because of that, he doesn't even have the sense that he is leading the community. Yeah, and of course, the point here is that he says, well, if anyone else thinks I should be leading the community, let them make some pronouncement. Well, what he's saying really is that actually it is inappropriate. Anyone who has understood these teachings fully, who has a full insight into non-self, would not want to or would not wish to take on that leadership position. In other words, there shouldn't be any leader. There shouldn't be any things apart from the teachings that are already there. So this is really what comes out, what actually is implied by this. And when you know the rest of the sutta, you know how the Buddha talks about after my passing away, only the Dhamma will be the teaching. Yeah, Dhamma and Vinaya will be the teaching. That's what he says. And that kind of reinforces this statement that the leadership now is actually the Dhamma, the teachings that I have bequeathed you. This is what is now the leader. This is what you refer to. Don't need to refer to any individual, any person. This is where you should go. So this whole idea of transmitting the Dhamma and creating leaders in the Dhamma is actually very different from what we see in the suttas. And this is, I think, a very important point that we need to consider also in the present day, because it is very easy for the sasana and the Buddhists become very hierarchical, where we actually have where we have the exact opposite of what we have here. We actually do have leaders. In many Buddhist countries you have the Sangha Raja. Sangha Raja literally means the king of the Sangha. So if you want hierarchy, there you have it. This is the exact opposite. At that time there was not even an abbot of the monastery. Everything happened in complete consensus. It was an absolute democracy in those days. And very useful for us to remind ourselves of this very egalitarian and very democratic structure of the Sangha. A democratic and egalitarian structure is far less likely to become corrupted. Corruption happens in hierarchy because everyone is striving to climb the hierarchy. Once you get the position, you have power. It means that you can control things. You can get things the way you like them. So everybody wants to have power. Everybody wants status. And that is where corruption happens. But in a flat structure, you can't really have much corruption. You can still have perhaps a little bit, but far less, because no one really is in a position to have any power of anyone else. Nobody is in a position to abuse the system. So this idea of a democratic and flat structure is very, I think, very beautiful and very powerful, and is something we should always strive to implement in the Buddhist life. And if you look around the world, it is actually, humanity seems to like hierarchies. We tend to always kind of come back to this idea of hierarchies. And yet, it is not actually the way the Buddhist sasana should be organized. I think very important to keep that in mind, because it is so easy. It seems like we tend to lean into that direction so naturally, and we always have to be careful before some strong man, or maybe occasional strong woman as well, takes over and then kind of, runs the whole thing as if it is some kind of autocracy and whatever. And then we destroy so much of the Sangha. Very often you hear about, reform movements in Buddhist countries, and very often the way they talk about reform, I think often they're missing some of the important points. If they really wanted to reform Buddhism, what they should do is to tear down some of the hierarchies, tear down the pyramids. Because the pyramid is kind of a classical structure of a hierarchy. Tear those down, and then maybe there will be less corruption, maybe there will be less problems in the Buddhist communities. I think the hierarchies are a very important part of the problem. But what is paradoxical is that the pyramids, the hierarchies, were actually made and put in place in the first place to deal with corruption in the Sangha. But I think they probably made it worse. Instead of dealing with it, they actually made it worse. The right way of dealing with corruption in the Sangha, in my opinion, is to be open about how monastics should live, how lay people should live. And then when everyone knows how people should live, there will be a natural selection, because people will move towards those people who live rightly and away from those who abuse the system or live wrongly. So give information. Information, education, I think, is always the best way of dealing with corruption and dealing with problems, because then there will be a natural way that these things sort themselves out. So a very important lesson here, and this is kind of the again, another paradox, is that nobody reads the suttas. So these important lessons that are right here, they never get to anyone, because nobody knows that, this is how it's supposed to be here. So this is another kind of weird thing here. Don't read the suttas, you don't get the message, and they go all wrong as a consequence of that. This is what, unfortunately, what tends to happen here. And I should also have mentioned, I didn't really talk about it properly, this idea of making no inner and outer again, this idea of having inner and outer and having a teacher's fist. This also implies the idea of having esoteric teachings, secret teachings that are held back and given out at certain times. This is also something that you see in Buddhism in the present day. A lot of these things, actually, where you have kind of special initiations and all this kind of stuff, very common in Buddhist circles. But actually, it goes against the way the Buddha talked about this. It should be open. It shouldn't be something that is, you have secret teachings. Because again, this is very open to abuse. If you have secret teachings, inner and outer circles, again, it tends to create all sorts of possibilities of abuse in that particular system, because everyone wants those secret teachings, and then some people then get elevated in the wrong way, and then everything starts to deteriorate because of that. So again, another I think very important thing where it's so easy to actually go wrong, and very often we do actually go wrong in this particular area. So the Buddhist ideal is very different from the idea of a cult. It's almost the opposite, where you don't have any people in charge. The Buddha is in charge, but because the Buddha has passed away, it's difficult to really have a cult around the Buddha in the same way as a living person. So there's no one, no real leader. There is no secret teachings. Everyone is roughly on par. There's a rough kind of democracy as far as you possibly can. It doesn't lend itself to a cultish behavior, and that is really the ideal here, I think, in Buddhism, to eliminate that possibility of having cults as much as possible. Of course, we still manage to make cults out of things, but at least we reduce it to the maximum. There you are. So I think all of these things are actually very important about how we organize ourselves and how we think about it. And they are very important for the Buddha society right here. They're important for the Bodhinyana Monastery and Dhammasara Monastery, that we actually implement, I feel, these things to the best of our ability, so as to make the Sasana and Dhamma last as long as we possibly can. Again, if anyone has any questions, you are more than welcome to ask at any time. So please just raise your hand or whatever as we go along here. Okay, so then the Buddha carries on. He says, "Ananda, I am now old, worn out, venerable, one who has traversed life's path. I have reached a term of life, which is 80. Just as an old cart is made to go by being held together with straps or bamboo, so the Tathagata's body is kept going by being strapped up, as it were. It is only when the Tathagata withdraws his attention from outward signs and by the cessation of certain feelings enters into the signless concentration of mind or stillness of mind that his body knows comfort." Again, you have this very naturalistic idea of the Buddha. Yeah, he's getting old, his body is worn out, it's falling out, it's like has to be held together almost like an old cart. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what, if this is a direct reference to anything, I'm not aware of that, but presumably the body is like, falling apart in terms of the senses not working properly perhaps, or and all of this kind of stuff. Maybe his legs aren't as good as they were, probably very likely, and all of this kind of stuff. A typical naturalistic understanding of the Buddha's body. Then he says that it is only when he withdraws his attention from all signs. The word sign is nimitta, and the same word that we use when we talk about meditation practice, and the idea of sign is basically any object of your consciousness, anything that you are aware of. When you see things and you see them having a certain lasting qualities, carpet, for example, is like a sign. You withdraw your attention from all of those things that are possible objects of consciousness. You don't have any object anymore. And the signless concentration of mind, where there is no sign, is like a radical observation of impermanence. Because when there is no object, it means everything is, you see everything as continuously impermanent. There's no object. An object is something which by definition is something that has a continuity to it. Yeah, you watch your breath or whatever it is, there's a certain continuity. When things have no continuity, that is a radical contemplation of impermanence. Things are always changing. So this is what is this idea of the animitta samadhi, or the signless concentration of mind. And this is one of those samadhis that is very closely related to insight, because you can only have this particular samadhi if you have insight into the impermanence of phenomena. It goes very closely related to each other. And as you do that, it is as if you are withdrawing your attention from all worldly things. And because you are withdrawing your attention from all the worldly things, it means that all the feelings that are connected with those worldly things, they also cease. Yeah? So all the feelings cease, and because the feeling cease, then the body obviously disappears as well, and you find some degree of comfort again. It is interesting why the Buddha, why does the Buddha talk about the Animitta Samadhi? Why doesn't he talk about the jhanas, for example, instead? The jhanas would have a similar kind of impact. Yeah, you withdraw from the body, and when you withdraw, you don't feel anything, and then the body also heals at the same time. Why is it here talking about the Animitta Samadhi? I don't know the exact answer to that. I suspect maybe the reason is that this Animitta Samadhi, because it is a samadhi which is only accessible to people who have full insight into the teachings, it is considered more elevated. Yeah? It's part and parcel of the insight that the Buddha has. So it's almost like saying the Buddha goes into some deep insight that is only accessible by people like him who have an insight into reality. That may be the reason. So you kind of, you're adding a little bit to the Buddha to say that he was special and he had access to these special samadhis. Probably nobody really knew what he was. Actually, he's supposed to say so himself, and it's actually the same in the other one. So quite likely he did actually, quite possibly he did actually attain that signless concentration or signless stillness of mind. It is quite possible that actually that was the case. So this is the only time when the Buddha's body is good. When he kind of withdraws attention, otherwise it is bad. So again, this naturalistic idea of the body. And then comes the last paragraph here of this particular section. And then the Buddha says the following here. Therefore, Ananda, you should live as islands unto yourselves, being your own refuge, with no one else as your refuge, with the Dhamma as an island, with the Dhamma as your refuge, with no other refuge. And how does a monk live in this way? Here, Ananda, a monk, a nun, or a layperson, or anyone, abides contemplating a body in the body, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, having put away desire and aversion for the world. And likewise, with feelings, he contemplates some feelings among feelings, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, having put away desire and aversion for the world. He contemplates certain qualities of mind, mind states, again, in exactly the same way. And the last one, the mind objects, or perhaps better, principles, Dhamma principles. In this exactly the same way, certain Dhamma principles among Dhamma principles, earnestly or energetically, clearly aware, mindful, having put away desire and aversion for the world. And then he says, that Ananda is how a monk or anyone lives as an island unto themselves, their own refuge, with no one else as their refuge, with the Dhamma as an island, with the Dhamma as your refuge, with no other refuge. And those who now in my time and afterwards live thus, they will go from darkness to the highest, if they are desirous of training. So here, what the Buddha is obviously doing here, he has seen how distressed Venerable Ananda is by his passing away, and he's basically reminding Venerable Ananda that the only refuge in life is actually to go back to the Dhamma, go back to the teachings. Everything else is so unstable. Here I am, yeah. Here you have me. I am kind of your refuge now in many ways, the Buddha. But I too am impermanent. I'm going to pass away. In the end, you can't hold on to me. I'm going to disappear as well, says the Buddha. And because of that, make sure that you have a refuge in a place that actually is worthy of that refuge. And this is such an important lesson, yeah, because the problem is that the vast majority of people take refuge in all sorts of things, and that's why they get distressed. Yeah, one of the kind of things in modern times, recently I went to a dana in somebody's house, and they asked me to talk about the political problems, or the political kind of constitutional problems in Sri Lanka, because in Sri Lanka they have recently had some turmoil in the parliament. They had two prime ministers for a while, and nobody knew who was in charge of the country anymore. It was kind of an interesting situation. It's two prime ministers, and they couldn't, I'm not sure what has happened since then, but So, and this is exactly the problem, yeah? You get upset because you see something happening in the political stage. You wonder what's going to happen. Or you see some politicians that you don't like coming, getting into power somewhere, yeah? And this happens all the time. There's always going to be politicians that we don't like getting into power, or some dictatorial tendencies kind of emerging in the politics and all of this kind of stuff. And then people get afraid. Why do we get afraid? Well, the reason is because we take our refuge in those things. Yeah, you expect society to work in a certain way. You expect democracy to carry on. You expect leaders to be reasonable. But should we really expect that? Not really. Why should we? If you look at history, there's no reason to expect these kind of things. Political leaders come and go. Wars come and go. We can't really expect next year. Will Australia be at war next year? Probably not, but it's not impossible. Yeah, these things can happen. We shouldn't really be too surprised. And with my thinking like that, what you're doing is that you are shifting your refuge away from those things that are inherently problematic, that are always going to change in ways that we don't expect. This is the problem with these things. The change is always in ways that we don't expect. Suddenly things happen that come out of the blue. And so we move our refuge away from those things towards things that actually have a degree of stability. And the Buddha here points to two things: take yourself as refuge and take the Dhamma as refuge. Those are the points of stability in life. It's such an important thing about so many things in life. We take refuge in other people. Yeah, even though we know they're going to have to die at some stage, we take refuge in whatever else is, in our body, in our status, in our belongings, in all of these worldly things, all these worldly phenomena that we know are inherently problematic. And this is why the contemplation of death is so powerful, because the contemplation of death actually makes it very clear how problematic these things are, how changeable they are, how they're often going to disappear at some eventually. And then again, it helps you to change your refuge away from things that are problematic towards something that actually is more stable. So what is that refuge? What does it mean to take? Well, to take the Dhamma as a refuge is kind of fairly easy to understand. It means taking the teachings of the Buddha as your refuge, going back to them to seek for advice when you have a problem. But what does it mean to take yourself as a refuge? Because sometimes we feel we don't know. Yeah, sometimes I don't know. I feel kind of confused myself. So how can I take myself as a refuge? And it is defined here quite specifically what it means. And what it means is practicing of meditation. Yeah, satipatthana practice, meditation practice. And as all of probably most of you will know, is that when you do meditate and you have some success in your meditation, you are pulling inside of yourself. You're pulling out of the world in a very real sense, into yourself, letting go of the world. The phenomenal reality around you is becoming less important. You let go of that, and instead you find a certain stability within. That is the refuge within. And the deeper that meditation is, the more easily you have access to that, the more easily you have access to something which is relatively stable within yourself. Yeah, this is why the Buddha here is talking about the satipatthanas, because you withdraw from the world and you build up something inside of yourself that you can access. This is far more easy for you to control if you practice in the right way than external phenomena. External phenomena are absolutely uncontrollable, whereas your inner life, at the very least, you have some degree of control. One of the nice teachings that Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Brahm's teacher, used to give, he used to say that, what is our real home? The real home, what is that? And he says the real home is precisely samadhi. Because when you withdraw inside of yourself, it's like you go to a place of safety, a place where all the external world that always impinges on us is kind of let go of. And you kind of go within yourself to a place where you are, you feel at ease, you feel relaxed, you feel good. And all of those things that you were looking for in the outer world actually is found inside of you. This is a far more real refuge than anything you can ever find in the real world. So take yourself as a refuge in part means that. In part, it also means to rely on your own understanding through the Dhamma. And when these things come together like that, then it becomes the only source of true refuge in life. So remember that. When you do that, you actually have something very extraordinarily powerful to guide you through the difficult times that always come. Yeah, when sometimes we get complacent because things seem to be going so well, and we think, yeah, now I've really discovered the secret. I'm happy all the time. Yeah, I have no problems anymore. And suddenly, bang! It hits you over like a hammer over the head, and suddenly you are suffering again. So easy to get complacent, when we always need to be careful and remind ourselves of these things. So, let's have a look at these four satipatthanas again that the Buddha talks about in so many places in the suttas. And it's always nice to be able just to remind ourselves fairly briefly of what they are about, because they are so important and such an important aspect of the Buddhist path. So, you contemplate a body in the body. And this just means that you contemplate the body from a particular point of view or a particular aspect of the body. And there's two main things that we can do. And the most important way of contemplating the body is to watch the breath. This is kind of the remarkable thing. The breath contemplation is the one contemplation or the one meditation practice that fulfills everything in the Satipatthana. Specifically stated in the Anapanasati Sutta. So this is one way of doing this. Another way of doing the watching the breath, watching the body, a body in the body, is to do the 31 parts of the body contemplation. Contemplate the 31 parts of the body, heart, lungs, liver. Where are they? I'm not sure where they are. Liver, brain, bone. What?
Minus the brain.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, 31. Okay, thank you. Thank you for reminding me of that one. Okay, we're talking about that, actually. So that is another way. This is one of the obviously very early contemplations of the body that you find in the sutta. That is also an important part of body contemplation. And then Vakasapa just said this very important point. Yeah, he said, he didn't actually say that, but he should have, maybe someone else, this happens to me quite regularly. I say 31 parts of the body. And then people come up to me afterwards and say, didn't you mean 32 parts of the body? No, I meant 31 parts of the body. Otherwise, I wouldn't say it. I wouldn't say 31 if I meant 32. No, I'm being naughty. Sometimes you make mistakes. That's okay. But so, what is the difference? What is this 31 and 32 business? And usually when people say 32 parts of the body, it actually shows that they're quite educated in Buddhism. Because it is true, most people, when we talk about meditation practice, we talk about 32 parts of the body. And this is a little bit of a side issue from what we're talking about, but it's a kind of a nice and I think an important side issue, actually. The reason why there is that conflict there is because in the suttas, it is always 31 parts of the body, but if you go to the commentaries, if you go to the Visuddhimagga, there is 32 parts. So why does the Visuddhimagga have 32 parts? Well, the suttas have 31 parts. Isn't this exciting? Yeah. Oh, this is really exciting stuff. But actually, it is much more interesting than you might think. Yeah. First of all, what is that 32nd part? It's the brain, right? It's kind of the point when Vakasapa was just making. It's the brain is the 32nd part. That brain is found in the Visuddhimagga. It is not found in the suttas. So if you contemplate the brain, does that mean that you are contemplating in the wrong way? That's not what it means, right? Obviously, it doesn't mean that. Whether you contemplate 31 parts or 32 parts, actually, it is completely irrelevant. But there is another reason why this is interesting. And the reason why it is interesting is because it shows you where people get their meditation instructions from. They don't usually get them from the suttas. They get them from somewhere else, from the commentaries, from the Visuddhimagga, from the Abhidhamma. Every time someone comes up to me and tells me 32 parts of the body, I know exactly where they got that information from. I know they haven't been reading the suttas properly. So that is very fascinating because it shows you how the Dhamma is practiced around the world. The vast majority of places base their understanding of the Dhamma not on the suttas, but on a later tradition, especially the Visuddhimagga. Visuddhimagga is a very important source for how meditation is practiced. If you want to find out, for example, how metta is practiced, usually it is practiced according to the Visuddhimagga method, which actually is different from the suttas. If you want to understand how insight is practiced in the traditional insight contemplations, it is again based entirely on the Visuddhimagga. If you want to understand how kasina meditation is done, it's always done according to the Visuddhimagga method. It's always based on the commentaries. So this is kind of the interesting point here, is that the vast majority of practitioners around the world, they base their meditation methods, including metta meditation, on instructions not given by the Buddha, but given by someone a long time after the Buddha passed away. So I personally think this is very interesting, because it shows how a danger, basically, that by using those later sources, there is always a danger we might get it wrong. In terms of the aspects of the body, I don't think it matters at all whether you contemplate 31 or 32 parts, or you can add a few of your own parts if you like. Yeah, you want to add some extra parts, we could do that, maybe 33, 34, or whatever. That's not really the point, but in other methods of meditation, for example, in metta meditation, there actually is a fairly significant discrepancy between how it is done in the suttas and how it is done in the Visuddhimagga. And sometimes it may be useful to contemplate that difference and try the different methods. And maybe you will find out that the method of the Buddha is more powerful and it works better for you than the method you actually find in the Visuddhimagga. Yeah, so I'm not going to go into the difference now, but the basic difference is that in the Visuddhimagga, the metta is done towards individuals. In the suttas, it is done towards directions, or towards, if you like, the world at large, rather than towards individuals. And when it comes to inside contemplation, it is far more dramatic, the difference that you find in the suttas, compared to what you find in the Visuddhimagga. It is very, very big difference. And yet, the Visuddhimagga method is what is used almost universally in the Buddhist world. Anyway, I told you it was going to be interesting, right? Yeah? So I hope you find that interesting. Otherwise, I apologize. So this is the contemplation of the body. Yes, this is the way you do it, and the main contemplation, as far as I'm concerned, is the breath contemplation, specifically said to fulfill all the satipatthanas. So this is contemplating one aspect of the body. And how should the contemplation be done? And this is the next part here. It should be done earnestly, clearly aware and mindful. The word earnestly is the Pali word atapi, yeah, and atapi is a word which is used in the suttas, which is pretty much synonymous with the idea of energetically, or putting forth effort. This is why he has used earnestly here. I guess he just means another way of making effort, presumably, or being energetic. I'm not sure if earnest is quite right. Of course, we have to be earnest, otherwise it doesn't work, but it's kind of ballpark correct. So what exactly does this mean? What it means, as I mentioned before, there is an important distinction in the suttas. On the one hand, with effort, and effort is when you deliberately apply yourself. You know that you are perhaps thinking the wrong thought, and then you ask yourself, how can I change the way I think, and think in a different way, so as to be more positive, not get negative about things, have more metta and all of that. So you deliberately change the way you think. Yeah, this is using effort be more wholesome in the way you look at the world. And then there is the other side, which is the energy side, which is something that develops naturally as a consequence of practicing the path, when the mind becomes energetic and bright as a consequence of the practice. And this is a different kind of different thing. You no longer have to apply energy, apply effort, because the energy of the mind at that point is actually automatic. And this word atapi that we see here, this earnestly, is actually somewhere in between that. The effort is found in the four right efforts, which is the sixth factor on the Noble Eightfold Path. This is satipatthana, which is the seventh factor on the Noble Eightfold Path. And the virya, the energy, is found when we start to develop the bhujangas, the bhujangas being the factors of awakening. That is when we're moving into the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is sammasamadhi. So this here is a kind of middle ground between
effort and energy, where we still put in a little bit of effort, but the mind is starting to get energized, and that kind of middle ground there. Yeah, so satipatthana is the middle ground between right effort and right stillness of the mind, and we're seeing how kind of energy and the effort is transforming from using a bit more force to the pure energy, somewhere in between those two grounds. So this is how I read this particular word, although it is usually taken to be synonymous with effort elsewhere in the suttas. So you have this energy or effort, you are clearly aware, yeah? We are now doing mindfulness of breathing, right? So you are clearly aware, it means that you know what is happening. Yeah, you're sitting there with your breath, and you know whether you are watching the breath or whether you are fantasizing about something. This is what clear awareness usually means. It means, are you fulfilling the purpose of what you're doing or what you're supposed to do? Are you fulfilling the purpose of a breath meditation or are you doing something else? Clear awareness knows whether you are, what you're doing is suitable and whether it's fulfilling the purpose of moving towards awakening or whatever. That's the standard understanding of clear awareness in the suttas. Clear awareness or full awareness is something that you have to take with you all the way along the path from the very beginning to the very end. Am I fulfilling this or not? This is what clear awareness is. And then you have the next one is mindful. Yeah, so, and of course the point of that is that you have to be mindful to actually practice satipatthana. And this is an important point because what this points us to, it points us to the standard translation of satipatthana, which is the four foundations of mindfulness, is actually inadequate, and I would say it is wrong. Because if something is the foundation of mindfulness, it implies that it is what you do to give rise to mindfulness. Yeah, this is the foundation of mindfulness, you do that, you can become mindful. But no, you actually have to be mindful before you become you do satipatthana practice. So the right translation, instead of being foundation of mindfulness, should more be like the application of mindfulness, or Ajahn Brahm likes to translate as the focus of mindfulness. It is how we use the mindfulness that has already been established. That is what it really is about. This makes quite a bit of difference, yeah? And one of the very important differences is that what it means is that we actually need to establish mindfulness properly before we can do mindfulness of breathing. This is one of the standard faults that people make when it comes to meditation practice. You sit down, you start watching the breath straight away. And many people teach like that. It's very common. There's some of the very large meditation circles actually teach precisely like that. As soon as you come on the retreat, you sit down, you watch the breath. But actually, it is not really adequate. For some people, it may work. But for most people, first of all, you need mindfulness to arise. Only when mindfulness has arisen is it really possible to watch the breath in a satisfactory way, where you don't use too much force, you don't use too much willpower, and you can relax and you can enjoy it. So little things like that actually matter significantly for whether you're going to enjoy your meditation practice or not. So how does the mindfulness come about? And the way the mindfulness comes about is by the previous practice of the first six factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, in particular, right effort. Yeah, if you practice right effort in the right way, you reduce and you eliminate the defilements of the mind to a large extent, then mindfulness comes about as a natural consequence. And when that mindfulness comes about as a natural consequence, then you apply it in the satipatthanas, and then mindfulness of breathing is natural and relatively easy as a consequence. So to understand these things rightly actually is matters enormously if you're going to have success in your meditation practice or the whole Buddhist path for that matter. And then we have the very last factor here, which is he has translated as putting away hankering and fretting for the world. In other words, having overcome desire and aversion for the world is really is probably a more comprehensible translation. Yeah, so desire and aversion, it means the world here is probably a reference to the world of the five senses. It is sometimes used like that in the suttas. The five senses are the world that we normally live in. So because that is our world, and that is somehow used sometimes called the world in the suttas. So the world of the five senses, which basically is everything we know, yeah, in our waking experience, you have withdrawn desire and aversion from that. And the reason you have done that, and the way you do that is through the right efforts. And of course, the reason we do that is to make the mind more stable and calm and more mindful. So we don't have the ups and downs of the mind, always being attracted, always desiring, then having aversion towards things, but having that evenness of the mind. And what is interesting about this is that that particular phrase, loki abid vinaya loki abhijadomanasa, having put away desire and aversion for the world, that phrase is actually found in the four right efforts. Abhijadomanasa, which is that critical phrase there, which means desire and aversion, is found in the four right efforts. And in the four right efforts, it is said that you overcome these things so as to avoid the mind being influenced by these things, so as to avoid all the asavas, the outflowings, the defilements, the corruptions of the mind from arising. So you actually, the exact same phrase is used in the four right efforts. That is where you abandon it, and that is why when you come to the Satipatthana, it says, having abandoned it. It has already been done. It has been eliminated before in the right efforts. Now you do the Satipatthana, and you carry on from there, having abandoned it. So you can see how these things fit together very nicely. One thing leading on to the other one. Words or phrases being used in the previous factor of the Noble Eightfold Path are reused in the following factor, but now you have finished, completed that task, and then you carry on with your new task, which now is one step higher up. And of course, that is obviously quite important. Yeah, it is important because how are you going to be mindful unless you have abandoned desire and aversion? There is no way. Desire and aversions are the enemies of mindfulness because they drag you into the past, they drag you into the future. The only way mindfulness is going to arise is if you abandon these to a very large extent. And this is why this is in there, obviously. So all of these things are the prerequisites that are required for mindfulness and for Satipatthana to actually work and to be practiced properly. These are like the adjectives or the qualities that qualify Satipatthana practice. And only when these are present are you actually doing the practice properly. I promise not to go on too much longer because I know that there's a lot here, but I'm just going to finish off this paragraph. Just on a few more minutes and we'll be done with this one. And then you watch the breath, then you do the 31 parts of the body, 31 or 32 parts of the body, then you are practicing this in the right way. Then it is the same thing for feelings. Feelings are contemplated in the same way. How do we contemplate feelings? There isn't any explicit method given in the Satipatthana Sutta how to do it. All it says is that there are these various kind of feelings and you contemplate them, but then you go to this Anapanasati Sutta, the mindfulness of breathing, and it tells you that is how you fulfill the contemplation of feelings. How do you do it? You just sit down, you watch the breath, joy and happiness arises. This is according to the sutta, not always according to reality, but according to the sutta. So you have all this joy and happiness, and that is how you contemplate feelings. That's all you have to do. Quite nice, isn't it? You just have to enjoy happiness and joy and you're contemplating feelings. And that's all you have to do. And one of the nice things about that, and I think it's important to make this point actually, is that very often in the meditation circles, people say, you have pain in your body, in your knees or your back or your bottom or whatever. People say, well, just sit there and watch that because that is like contemplation of feeling. You contemplate feelings in the body. But actually, the way the Buddha teaches this in the Anapanasati Sutta, there is no need whatsoever to contemplate those painful feelings. You can go straight to the happy feelings, contemplate pity, sukha, joy and happiness, and by doing that, you are actually fulfilling the contemplation of feelings. And the reason for that is because if you understand the happy feelings, you can see the absence of the painful feelings, you understand the painful feelings through their absence. The most powerful way of understanding painful feelings, I have a bit of painful feeling now, so I'm going to move a little bit. The most powerful way of understanding something is through its absence, because when it's completely gone, you know what it is, because now it's no longer there. So you understand it through its absence. So this is why it is possible to understand painful feelings completely just by looking at the happy feelings. Isn't that great? I think this is just so wonderful. You know, so many people spend so much time with pain and problems and suffering, and then they are told that this is the right way. But actually, I haven't really seen people getting any all that profound insights by contemplating painful feelings. I became an arahant through contemplating painful feelings. I haven't seen that so often. Actually, probably never. But I think it's such a positive message. And to me, it actually chimes with the overall message of the Buddha, that happiness is really what the Buddhist teaching is about. The Buddhist path, the happiness is what is emphasized again and again. And you don't actually have to spend too much time contemplating the problems in life. You just know, you often contemplate them through contemplating the opposite, which are the happy feelings. Such a wonderful thing. So please don't contemplate too much painful feelings. If you have painful feelings, move a little bit, change your posture, and then go straight for the happiness if you possibly can. Far more powerful, far deeper, far more conducive to insight, far more conducive to living the spiritual life for a long time in the future, if that is what you want to do. And why wouldn't you want to do that? What else is really worthwhile doing in this life? So just a small point, I just wanted to put in there because I think it's such an important thing here. Then you have the idea of contemplating mind as mind, or this refers to certain aspects of the mind. And again, it is not specifically said in the Satipatthana Sutta how to do that. It just says that there are various qualities of mind and you contemplate those. But in the Anapanasati Sutta, the mindfulness of breathing, again, it tells you, you do this simply by watching the breath. So everything happens through watching the breath. And again, you don't really have to contemplate all the difficult aspects of mind. According to the Anapanasati Sutta, all you have to contemplate is things like the nimittas, the brilliant lights in the mind, and the joy and the gladdening, and all that kind of stuff. And again, that is sufficient. And that will teach you all about, you need to know about the defilements and everything else. And then the last Satipatthana is what is here translated as mind objects. But I prefer the translation principles, and especially the principle of conditionality, because this last one is all about conditionality, understanding the five hindrances, understanding what causes them, how they arise, how they disappear, understanding the seven factors of awakening, what they are, how they arise, how they disappear, understanding this network, how everything in the world exists according to the network of cause and effect. The more you understand that network, the more your ability to overcome the problems and your ability to develop the wholesome opposites instead. You understand principles of Dhamma, causality, really. And of course, the Buddhist teachings are through and through causal teachings. Nothing exists inherently on its own. This is what the Anatta doctrine is all about. And if nothing exists inherently on its own, it means everything exists according to cause and conditions instead. So this is so fundamental to the Buddhist outlook. So there you are. That is how you live, as an island unto yourself. You go inward. You contemplate the world, you find the joy and happiness within, and you learn how to have insight into phenomena, insight into mind and body. And as you do that, of course, the independence rises dramatically. The more insight you have, the more independent you feel from the world. That is one of those beautiful qualities of the Dhamma, the kind of gradual arising of independence, the gradual freeing. It's not another aspect of freeing yourself from the world. You feel independent, you feel free of these things, and the world can no longer touch you in the same way that it used to. And then the Buddha says at the very end there, and those who now in my time and afterwards live in this way, they will become the highest. Tamat agga is the Pali word here, and it has been translated by others as they will go from darkness to the highest, which is perhaps one possible translation. The idea is presumably just that this is how you get somewhere on the path. But it is conditioned on one thing. You have to be desirous of learning, it says here. Sikkha kama really should be training. You have to be desirous of training here. And if you desire and you enjoy the training, then you are going to go a long way. And then you will go from darkness to brightness, go move towards the highest possible aspects of the Buddhist path. And what a wonderful thing that is. So, there you are. Are you all exhausted by now? It's a long, quite a long session. You're all very quiet. Is that because you are falling asleep, or is it because you are just... Can you understand anything I say? Does it make sense? Yeah, yeah, great. Yeah, John, please. Yeah,
yeah. Just going back a little bit. So that what was said in previously, what has been said previously, that Mara talked the Buddha into finishing off, telling him that he's achieved everything and yeah, no need to stay. So that's not correct then, is that right?
Well, this is one of those things, exactly, that I have always found very strange myself. Mara comes to the Buddha and says, okay, now it's time for you to kind of, you know, get off the scene, you know, Buddhism is established, you know, please disappear. And the Buddha kind of says, yes. Strange, isn't it? Mara is the one who kind of says to the Buddha, this is what you should do. And the Buddha kind of follows Mara's orders almost. It's very, very weird. I mean, it kind of undermines the authority of the Buddha quite dramatically if Mara, who is kind of the sworn enemy of the Buddha, dictates the terms of his final enlightenment. It's kind of very strange. And to me, it doesn't make any sense at all. I can't really make any sense of that kind of passage. And I find the whole thing, to me, has the air of being something that was added later on to explain something that nobody could really understand. Why did the Buddha disappear? There must be some explanation for this. Surely it's Mara's fault, yeah? Mara is always the dodgy one who kind of comes and does bad things. So I find it very, very hard to understand how that can make any sense. The Buddha would have known that his life was coming to an end anyway. Now is the right time to die. And then he makes a decision to let go of living. And then he dies because the body is getting old. That, to me, is what makes sense. And so many of these other things, slightly supernatural things, I find them very incoherent and very dubious, to say the least. And this is what I think with this whole Mara episode. Yes, Huitong here.
I just can't help but to ask, Ajahn.
Yeah, please. No.
Is this sutta ratified in the first council?
Is it ratified in the first council? We don't know. We have
according to legend, I mean, the first council is only comprised by all the Phubal Ajahn, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is quite likely that this sutta did not exist at the first council. I think it's quite likely, and I think it was probably put together afterwards. You know, one of the interesting things that you see when you read the account of the first council, you have Mahakasapa, who was in charge of the council, yeah, and he sits there, and then he asks Venerable Pali about the Vinaya, and then he asks about where the certain rules were laid down, and all of this extra material, he asks specifically about that. And then he asks Venerable Ananda about the suttas. And when he asks about the suttas, he asks in a similar kind of way. Yeah? First of all, you get the content of the sutta, and then the Buddha asks, who were the protagonists? Who were the people who were involved in speaking the sutta? Where was it given? Yeah, and he asks about all the material that later on became the narrative, but actually asked about at that first council. So it seems from that the narrative, the framing narrative, which kind of begins with where the Buddha was staying, and perhaps the concluding narrative at the end of the sutta, actually was given at the first council. Now, the Mahapanibbana Sutta is all narrative. Yeah, it doesn't really have any kind of coherent content. It's not really a sutta in the ordinary sense. So it seems very unlikely that this sutta would actually have existed at the first council, because all this narrative actually started out at the first council as questioning by Mahakasapa of Venerable Ananda and Venerable Upali. And That is one thing. Another thing is that the Mahapanibbana Sutta, there is quite a lot of differences in the various traditions as well, between some of the aspects here. Some are more expanded, some are less expanded. In particular, when you have these numbered lists, the seventh of that and the eighth of that, those lists are often longer in some of the other suttas than they are in the Pali. Two or three Chinese versions of the sutta. There is a Sanskrit version of it, and they varied in length. And all of this points to suttas that have been expanded over a period of time, sometimes after the various schools starting to split off and go in different directions and things. So I would say, yes, I think very likely the Mahapanibbana Sutta was largely made up and constructed perhaps even as late as the Second Council or after the Second Council, so quite a long time afterwards. Some of the core aspects would have been there early on, but the actual overall sutta would have been a fairly late construction, I would say. Thank you.
Do some of the individual stories in the Parinibbana Sutta, it's obviously it's made of a sequence of quite, chapters, I suppose. Do they have many parallels in the other suttas?
Some of them do have parallels,
And some of them?
And some of them don't. A lot of the things that we have been read, of course, obviously the Satipatthana has lots of parallels, the last part here. Most of the other things we have been reading here does not have parallel anywhere else. That's actually unique to this particular sutta. But the interesting thing is, it has parallels, but which way does the parallel go? Did it start out in the Parinibbana Sutta and then make its way into the other suttas, or was it the other way around? And that is one of the interesting questions that sometimes people, it's kind of not clear. And sometimes it could be both ways in a sense. But sometimes I think it would originally have come from the Mahapanibbana Sutta and then made its way back into the suttas as well, because there are some things that are quite unique and they fit well into the context here, not necessarily as well into the context elsewhere.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, Nicolette.
You talked about insight contemplation and that there's a significant difference in the way it's practiced or described in the suttas versus the commentary.
Yeah.
I didn't quite catch that. Would you mind going over that again, please?
Okay. So insight, how it is done in the suttas compared to the commentaries. And when I talk about the commentaries, I mostly mean the Visuddhimagga, which is like this enormous, you know about the Visuddhimagga? Yeah. Which is this manual of meditation, really, that was written by Buddha Gosa about 1,000 years after the Buddha. And in that Visuddhimagga manual, there's a large chapter on insight, which talks about various kind of stages of insight. And those stages of insight are not found anywhere in the suttas. Actually, two or three of them have a kind of precursor in the suttas, but the majority of that is not found in the suttas anywhere at all. That system is what is used in most, some of the main insight meditation systems you find in the world today are based precisely on that system and the Visuddhimagga. I'm not really saying it is wrong or anything like that. All I'm saying is different from the suttas, and to me that is interesting already in its own right. The way that insight is explained in the suttas, the most classical example is found in the Anapanasati Sutta. And the way it is explained there is that you go through the various stages of Anapanasati. Then at the end, when you come out of your meditation, then you contemplate that process you have been through in terms of anicca, in terms of viraga, nirodha, patanisaga, impermanence, fading away, cessation, and relinquishment. So you look back on that process and you see how the whole process is imbued with these characteristics of changing, things ultimately finally disappearing, and as a consequence of the disappearing, you let go of it, and that's the relinquishment at the end. So that is the classical way I would say it is described in the suttas. So it's quite a big difference there, whereas the Visuddhimagga is very systematized, and you're supposed to go through various stages and things. Okay, so let's have a look at what we have from overseas. We have Evie from California in the USA, who asks, what are the values that teacher, abbots, and supervisors should live by if we would like to emulate the democracy in the Sangha? Okay, so that that's a good question, and I think that's a good point, because I think that the democracy that we find in the Sangha, obviously, I think with modern Buddhist institutions that are far broader than the Sangha, I think it is useful to actually bring those ideas of democracy also into modern institutions. Yeah, maybe the Buddhist society here, sometimes we're not that democratic. Yeah, I see how the committee functions. It's not always super. It's democratic, but not kind of the democratic in the way that the Sangha is. So the Sangha ideal is one of absolute democracy, where everyone agrees. Yeah. So if you have a committee, for example, that runs an organization, or it could even be done by consensus through the whole membership, perhaps. But ideally, decisions are arrived at by consensus rather than by just an ordinary majority, which is kind of the standard democracy. And the beautiful thing about that is it leaves nobody out. Everybody is included. Everybody needs to be heard. And then you come to compromises rather than the majority suppressing the minority. Everyone has to compromise. That's kind of nice. It's a beautiful thing to learn, to compromise in this world. Instead of being a strong leader who kind of stamps his or her authority on the organization, instead, everyone needs to compromise a little bit. And I think you have often much more healthy systems when that happens. This is one of the, I think, very important things that comes out of the suttas. And the other thing which comes out is the idea of decentralization. In the Vinaya, all monasteries are completely independent of the larger Buddhist world. And I think the same thing is nice also to implement in Buddhism in society. Yes, we can cooperate in certain areas, but in the end, every organization is independent of other organizations. We run independently. We are able to react or able to deal with the local conditions, whatever they are, because we, instead of being part of a hierarchy, we have that freedom to react to what actually is required in every in a particular context, in a particular place. So those are probably, I would say, the two main principles, Dhamma principles. And it means less kind of strongman leadership and more compromising. And I think compromising person is a very, very healthy thing. It leads to less conflict. It leads to more harmony and cooperation. I think it's a very, very positive way of doing things. Okay, question number two from May Saw from Singapore. Could you please elaborate more on your mention of dealing with corruption and secret teachings from the Dhamma today? I think if you have been around the Buddhist scene for a while, you will know that it is quite common that there are secret teachings, that there are teachings that are given out to disciples. You look at the disciple has to reach a certain stage, and then you give them an extra teaching, and then they carry on, they prove their worth, and then you give them some more secret teachings called esoteric. Esoteric means secret, really, teachings. And it's quite common in the Buddhist world. It's obviously common also outside of the Buddhist world, but it happens also in Buddhism, despite the warnings from the Buddha that we see here. And I personally feel that already we are kind of heading slightly in the wrong direction if we have esoteric teachings. It really goes against the way the Dhamma is supposed to be. It's supposed to be open, free for everyone, available to everyone. We shouldn't hold back these teachings. They are here, given out of compassion from the Buddha. If they're given out of compassion, who are we to hold back on these things and say, you are not ready for that or whatever? We give them out freely, and then we explain them if people don't understand them properly. I think that what you see is that when you have these kind of esoteric teachings, very often it leads to abuse, it leads to power relationships, because obviously the person who has those teachings and who dispenses them to others, they are in a position of power, and it kind of creates this unequal relationship, which is very ripe for abuse because of that. So I think it is an unhealthy way of doing things. I remember many years ago, before I became a Buddhist, I don't know, that's a long time ago now, I did some transcendental meditation that was based on esoteric mantras. You're given some kind of a secret mantra that you're supposed to recite, nothing really all that meaningful. It was just kind of some kind of word that they had made up, a Sanskrit word or something that you're supposed to say, but it was kind of kept secret. And of course, that created a little bit of that atmosphere of kind of it being special, yeah? And it created some of that structure, hierarchical structure. And in retrospect, I think that was not a very good thing at all, actually. But we have it in Buddhism as well. We have it everywhere. So just watch out for that. Dealing with corruption again, I think this comes together with secret teachings very often. Yeah, corruption happens. People that become too powerful, they have too much authority or whatever, and then corruption happens as a consequence. And we have seen that a lot in the Buddhist world recently. Abuse, corruption, large, really very serious problems around the world. If you have read a little bit of what's happening in the Buddhist world, you will know about that. And very often it has happened in places where people have been put on a pedestal, yeah, way, way too high on the pedestal. And then they gain so much power that they start to abuse their situation. Sometimes, instead of being a democracy, they become like almost like kings or lords, yeah, like feudal lords put on a pedestal. And literally, they become incredibly powerful within large organizations sometimes. It ends up in tears, yeah, it ends up tragically because of that. So the idea of flat societies, I think, is a very, very healthy one. I think you get far less corruption in that way. Bodhinyana Monastery is not too bad in that sense, probably not perfect, but it's not too bad. Every monk is able to speak up as he wishes in our monastery. I wouldn't say that everyone has the same authority as Ajahn Brahm, that would be exaggerating massively, but at the very least, we can discuss things and talk about anything pretty much. And if Ajahn Brahm is outvoted, he will normally accept that at the Sangha meeting. I think that is a very healthy way of doing things. Okay, that's it for now. That was session number 8. So session number 9 happens when does that happen, Nicholas? Next time, yeah. Next year sometime. Okay, next year. So we'll see what happens. Okay, so let's pay respect to the Bodhidharma Sangha.